From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll look at a new report that finds traffic deaths have gone up in Milwaukee County, while decreasing in other parts of the state. Capitol Notes explores the political implications of the student protests. We'll learn about the 1886 Bayview Massacre.
This was shoot to kill. And I think the message they were sending and responding to was basically that industrial property is of higher value than industrial workers.
Plus, we'll meet a woman who started college in 1969, but never finished. Now, 55 years later, she's graduating from UWM.
I got to the point where I could take a breath and look around and say, what are the things that I wished I'd done? And one of the things I wished I'd done is finish college.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Reckless driving and speeding has become a defining issue for Milwaukee County. A recent report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum finds this has led to an increase in traffic deaths. The report shows rising numbers in the county, especially for Black residents, sharply contrasts the statewide trend where traffic deaths have been declining for decades. Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski is joined by Mark Sommerhauser with the Wisconsin Policy Forum to look at the report.
So your report goes into details behind why traffic deaths have surged in Milwaukee County particularly while declining elsewhere. But before we get into current numbers, let's talk about what you called the, quote, acute phase of the pandemic. So can you share more about that period and the data that it represents?
Yes. So the trends that we look at in our report are long term. They go back over the last couple of decades, especially over the last decade. But there was definitely, I would say, an inflection point that we can see in these data just from 2019 to 2020. 2020 obviously being the first year of the pandemic. And that's when we really saw nationally and in Wisconsin and in Milwaukee County a pretty significant uptick in crash fatalities, traffic accidents of all kinds, including traffic fatalities and crash fatalities. You know, we had been seeing in Milwaukee County, there was, you know, a longer running trend. There was a trend that kind of started in the early to mid 20 teens of increasing crash fatalities. Then those fatalities actually seemed to be plateauing or even maybe dropping off a bit in 2018, 2019. But then unfortunately in 2020, we saw quite a large uptick, one of the biggest annual increases that we have in the data from 19 to 20. And I think that kind of sets the stage for where we are in the most recent year of data that we looked at, which was 2022. You know, unfortunately, from 2020 through 22, we saw some continuing increases, particularly in Milwaukee County with crash fatalities, leading us to the place that we're at in that most recent year of data.
So while we might observe on the road thinking that the pandemic was like the trigger point that created more problems, some of these trends actually predate it, right?
Correct. That's exactly right. This report for us was meant to be sort of an update to a report that we did back in early 2020. And in that report, we were looking at data from 2013 to 2018. And we were already starting to document some of the trends that we talk about here at that time. They were already starting to show up. And we wanted to just revisit that and kind of see where we are with some of those trends. And unfortunately, what we found out is that, especially in Milwaukee County, you know, some of those increases that we documented have only continued in the period since, especially from, you know, the last 3 years from which we have data, 2020 through 22.
Right. So as you mentioned, your report gives us data up to 2022. So it shows that while Wisconsin reduced its motor vehicle fatality rate more than the nation itself, statewide data depicts a really different reality for Wisconsinites, especially along the lines of race, ethnicity, and geography. So can you share more about how you broke that up and what those stark differences are in these sections?
Yeah, so I think it's kind of interesting because this is a classic example of why a lot of times when you have large data sets, you want to break them down, because you look at what's happening at a statewide level, there's not really huge shifts one way or another. But boy, when you apply some of these, you know, whether it's lines of geography, whether it's race, that's where you start to see some really starkly different trends. If you look outside of Milwaukee County, if you look at white Wisconsinites, what you see is improvement. You see a picture that's getting better. The crash fatality rate among white Wisconsinites has declined very steadily for two decades. The crash fatality, both total fatalities and the crash fatality rate for the other 71 counties outside of Milwaukee County, has been declining for a number of years. But then, unfortunately, when we look within Milwaukee County, when we look at the Black and Hispanic populations, about two-thirds of Wisconsin's Black population does reside in Milwaukee County. It's not a majority of Wisconsin's Hispanic population. I think it's close to 40% maybe. It's a large plurality of Wisconsin's Hispanic population in Milwaukee County. But when we look at those groups, we see increases that are really concerning. And that's kind of what we tried to document here.
Yeah, so let's get into some of those specifics. Can you share more about what you found for the reality of Black residents when it came to the numbers and rates you found in the data?
Yeah, and this was something that was really at the core of our 2020 report. And unfortunately, this has really just continued in the period since. So what we see here is that there's been a really significant increase over the two-decade period in the crash fatality rate for Black Wisconsinites. I'm unfortunately not able to give you kind of figures over the long term. The reason for that is the data source that we use, which is the Centers for Disease Control, actually back in 2018 started to adopt new criteria for defining race of the individuals that they're tracking. This is a database of mortality. It's based on death certificates. And so it was an effort by the CDC to have a more sophisticated definition of race that grapples with the fact that many more, you know, Americans are identifying as biracial and all these things. The only trick is for us when we try to compare long-term trends, it really complicates our ability to do that. The best number I can give you is just since 2018, fatality rates for Black, non-Hispanic Wisconsinites have increased about 10%. It's definitely much larger, I can tell you, over the two-decade period. We just can't give an exact number again because of those changes in some of the methodology for CDC, but we know that there's been a significant increase in that crash fatality rate for Black Wisconsinites over the long term. Hispanic Wisconsinites is an area where we're still, I would say, in a little more of a wait and see mode, but definitely concerned. There's not as compelling of a long-term trend among Hispanic Wisconsinites, but there is just within about the last 4 years, pretty sharp uptick of about 45%. The crash fatality rate. So that's definitely concerning because certainly we don't want to see that increase continuing. And we did see an increase nationally because there's been an uptick overall just in the last 5 years in crash fatalities. So, you know, we're kind of trying to get a sense of how much of this is a Wisconsin specific trend versus a national trend. But again, that's an area that we think bears watching.
So we're talking about crash fatality rate, and that involves both motor vehicle crashes and pedestrian-involved crashes. But can you share with us what the key factor was that contributes to these crash fatality trends?
Yeah, you know, that's obviously really, really difficult to say. I think that it seems clear that one of the factors that we know is contributing is speeding-related deaths. So that, to me, honestly, it was probably the most striking data point in our whole report. If you look at crash fatalities for which law enforcement deemed excessive speed to be a factor, over the last two decades in Milwaukee County, those have increased 213%. If you look in the other 71 counties in Wisconsin, those have decreased 55%. So, you know, you're not going to find a much more stark divergence than that. You know, the majority of these fatalities are not speeding involved, but an increasing share of them are. You know, it's getting close to almost half now of these fatalities being speeding involved. Just those are the Milwaukee County fatalities. So that is really clearly part of the issue. You know, this is an issue that dates back in Milwaukee County more than a decade, unfortunately.
So what kind of steps are local and state policymakers doing to show that they're taking this problem seriously? I mean, with these kind of numbers and also what we can just observe in our day-to-day when we are driving out on the road, how are they trying to use this kind of data to help them interrupt this trend at least, you know, if not reverse it, but at least interrupt it?
Yeah. So I think one thing that is really notable is that since we put out our previous report in early 2020, there's no question that local and state policymakers have really increasingly prioritized this issue. They, you know, are really doing a lot more now to try to take some steps to make streets in Milwaukee safer And we felt like that was important to note in our report, even though we feel like there's more to do. The city, so just to run through a few things real quickly here, the city has joined the International Vision Zero Initiative, which is trying to get traffic deaths down to zero in the, over the long term. You know, that's obviously an ambitious goal, but they have a lot of things, concrete things that they're putting into play here that I think are going to have an impact. Probably one of the most notable things that you, I'm sure, have witnessed is all these efforts to try to re-engineer some of the streets in Milwaukee to both do road diets where you do fewer lanes, narrower lanes that have been shown, research has shown that it overall does cause people to drive more slowly. It is also working to increase the number of Milwaukee police that are assigned to enforce serious driving violations. I think some of these efforts also have the county, Milwaukee County, engaged as well. At the state level, lawmakers have passed, and the Governor Tony Evers has signed a number of laws, especially just in the last year and a half, that are aimed at curbing reckless driving, including laws that increase criminal penalties for reckless driving, for folks who try to flee a police officer in a vehicle. Also, there's another bill that is increasing funding for driver's ed for high school students. So, you know, there are a number of things that the state has done. I think there is, of course, more in particular that local officials would like to see the state do, especially around, you know, giving law enforcement and local officials more enforcement tools. You know, we cite, and I think the most high profile examples of this would be the red light cameras that, you know, currently are not permitted under state law. The legislature would have to pass a law to authorize Milwaukee or any other city to be able to put those in. That's one that I know Mayor Johnson has been really vocal about. And there certainly are some considerations with those, both around privacy, around the accuracy of who is cited. If you have somebody, for instance, that were to steal a car and then run a red light, how do you make sure that you know, that you're actually holding the correct person responsible? There are also concerns around equity with red light cameras. But I think you have to think about, when you think about equity there, you have to think about both, you know, the individuals that might be held accountable through red light cameras, but also the individuals that might be potentially protected from fatalities as a result of, you know, heightened enforcement, because certainly people running red lights is one of the significant ways that you have really serious crashes. So we think that's something that warrants some more discussion and some more consideration.
Mark Sommerhauser is the communications director and a policy researcher for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. At WUWM.com, you can find a link to his recent report about traffic deaths surging in Milwaukee County.
From Milwaukee's NPR, this is Capital Notes. We break down the big political news affecting Wisconsin. I'm Ayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics.com. He provides a roundup of the Wisconsin developments you need to know. Here's our latest conversation. Hi, J.R., welcome back to Capital Notes.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right, so since we spoke 2 weeks ago, there's been a surge of protests on college campuses in the country involving tent encampments over the war in Gaza, including at UW-Madison and UW-Milwaukee. This is an election year. What are the political implications of this development on the race for president in Wisconsin?
Well, go back and look at what happened in the primary in Wisconsin in April with the uninstructed vote. Remember, that's the option for people voting in the Democratic primary. If they weren't happy with Joe Biden, that they could go ahead and vote uninstructed. It was basically a way to, you know, signify people's unhappiness with his policies, especially toward Israel and the conflict over there. People argued to me after that vote that, okay, look, it's April, people are unhappy, but they'll come home come November because it's Trump on the ballot against Biden. Well, now you're seeing these protests, people are kind of wondering, well, will they really come home? Because, look, you know, school's out, finals are coming up, and then kids will go home for the summer, so that will help dissipate things. But what about in the fall? What if there isn't a ceasefire by September and the classes start up again? Could you see this play out all through the fall into November? Possibly. That has some Democrats worried that it'll be harder to reunify the party over this issue by November, when that really is going to matter.
Tamara Keith is an NPR reporter, and she noted that Biden continues to try with other world leaders to encourage a ceasefire, but he doesn't really seem like he's moving towards the more progressive wing of his party. She notes that there are real divisions about the protests, whether they're effective, whether the rhetoric has turned too far to the left to be considered anti-Semitism. Do you see this affecting coalitions on the left in Wisconsin?
Oh, it's definitely impacting the kind of the coalition in Wisconsin in terms of that youth vote. Remember, in 2022, in November election, in spring of 2023, there's a perception that college kids turned out in big numbers, especially in the abortion issue, and helped Tony Evers win re-election as governor, helped Janet Protasiewicz to her 11-point win in the Supreme Court race. Will those kids be as enthusiastic this fall about Joe Biden with this issue? Now, remember, there's also a disconnect between the average person on campus and those who are protesting, real people versus those on social media. It's not necessarily a reflection of everybody. But there's definitely a vocal part of that youth group, that block of voters, unhappy and making their voices heard. Will that carry through to the fall? That's the big question. Will it keep going through November?
And what about coalitions on the right? We've seen people like Assembly Speaker Robin Voss weigh in on this, U.S. Senate candidate Eric Hovde, Congressman Derek Van Orden. How are they trying to, in a sense, capitalize on this?
So for conservatives, I mean, one, they see the opportunity to highlight the more extreme voices in these protest movements to basically label everybody who's protesting as anti-Semitic, even if they're not, they're all being lumped together. And two, they see an opportunity to make an argument there's still chaos. Remember back in 2020 when Joe Biden was elected president, he ran on this theme that he was going to kind of bring order. He was going to make things less hectic all the time because, you know, Donald Trump was always on then Twitter every day making statements that roiled, you know, people and the markets and everything else. Biden talked about how a return to normalcy. Well, fast forward to now, and like there's inflation out there. People are unhappy. There are protests on college campuses. It's just a way for Republicans to say, look, there's still chaos. He promised you like this sense of calm, and he's not delivering it. So it's a way to kind of make an argument that Biden's not living up to his promises, and that there's maybe when people are unhappy about the direction of the country and the economy, it plays into that, and they can play off those feelings to amplify him with these college protests, saying, hey, look what's going on. Are you happy about this too?
And of course, this is, you know, these protests are about foreign policy. They're about things happening thousands of miles away. Other political experts have said that elections generally aren't won or lost on foreign policy. Do you think that's not accurate this year?
It just depends. But with these protests, there are people unhappy. And again, if it's enough to keep them home, that's a problem for Joe Biden. Remember, he only won Wisconsin by like 20,600 votes or something like that in 2020. He can't afford to lose any piece of his coalition to win unless Trump loses people from his coalition in 2020. Don't forget, you know, we keep seeing these primary votes in the Republican side where, you know, Nikki Haley's getting 15, 20% of the vote. There's some unhappiness on the Republican side as well. And what I'm wondering is, we had like 3.3 million people vote in Wisconsin in 2020 in that presidential race. It was, I think, less than 3 million in 2016. Where are we going to be at for a presidential race? People talk about in polls the double haters. They're people who don't like either Biden or Trump. If their people are that unhappy with their choices, will they just stay home? If they just stay home, who's going to be the most enthusiastic to turn out? That's a huge question. We see in some polling that Trump voters are more enthusiastic about the election. But we also see time and again in these special elections where Democrats outperform their expectations, driven by issues like abortion. So it'll be interesting to see if it is a low turnout election compared to what Wisconsin's used to, who's the most motivated and how that impacts the overall vote total.
You're tuned in to Lake Effect. I'm WWM's Mayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics.com. Okay, so switching gears here for a moment to fundraising. A member of the state GOP's executive committee has called for an overhaul of the party's fundraising approach after a disappointing start to 2024. Can you fill us in on that?
Sure. Looking through the finance reports through the end of March, the Democratic Party of Wisconsin outraised the Republican Party by like 15 to 1. Now, there's been a disparity in the fundraising for a while now. Ben Wickler, the Democratic State Party chair, is a phenomenal fundraiser. They have got a great machine working over there between his national ties. And, you know, it's easier to raise money as a party when you have the governor's office. So Wickler and Governor Evers are a great team in terms of fundraising. And for Republicans, they were so frustrated with the disparity that they went to a paid chair model a year and a half ago. Brian Schimming has been that first paid chair in years, and so far it's not reaping any reward for going that route. And the argument from Will Martin, one of the executive committee members, is that they need to kind of ramp things up, that there is too much competition for in-state dollars between the new legislative maps and how the Assembly Republicans and Senate Republicans will be working for, you know, competing for those dollars for their legislative races, that Eric Hovde running for U.S. Senate is going to be looking for money from state donors, that the national Republican National Convention coming to Milwaukee, that the people putting that on are asking Wisconsin donors for money. He's saying we should be diversifying our portfolio, essentially, and going out state to find people. And I've heard that argument from Republicans before of, you look, if you are an Illinois business person in Chicago, and you're a Republican, you're not going to win the state legislature in Illinois. Why would you give money to the state GOP in Illinois? Why aren't Republicans in Wisconsin going to those folks and saying, hey, there's a chance to really change things here? The Democratic Party, you know, they go to California a lot. They have a lot of big donors out there. There are Republicans in California. They write checks. Same like in New York. Both very blue states top the ticket, but there are opportunities there to raise money. And the questions being asked by Republicans I talked to is, why isn't the state GOP doing a better job of getting those out-of-state donors to invest in Wisconsin? And they're needed with all the competition for in-state money with what's going on to really help the party turn things around.
But you did mention that the state Democratic Party has outraised its Republican counterpart 15-1 through the first quarter of 2024. What does that, I mean, why is that important for somebody who's not a political watcher to know about that?
Because that money's used to pay for infrastructure. So, like, both parties have a state campaign fund and a federal campaign fund. There are rules about how you use state money versus federal money. So the Democratic Party of Wisconsin can't go use state money to cut an ad supporting Tammy Baldwin, right? That's a federal candidate. They can't do that. But there are ways to use that state money to pay for people who knock on doors, people who, you know, people who come out to help drive turnout, to put staff on the ground. And there's a mix of state and federal dollars paying for that. They have more resources to hire more people. That means more opportunities to turn out people who maybe are reluctant about Joe Biden or maybe don't know enough about what's going on to have taken a side. I mean, there's just more opportunities to get people engaged when you have more dollars. That's the way it works in politics. So they can pay for infrastructure that Republicans, they will definitely get help from the national committee. Trump building a campaign here would help. But Democrats overall in Wisconsin just are well out ahead of Republicans from Joe Biden's campaign onto the state party. They have more resources.
And, you know, you've mentioned this 15-1 haul in the beginning of 2024. What does it mean on the bottom line? Like, what's in the bank accounts? Do you know that number?
So as of kind of the last reports they had filed, Democrats had about a 5-1 cash in hand advantage over the Republicans. What I'm watching for is there'll be a report due in mid-July that'll give us a fuller look at the first 6 months of 2024 and see if the Republicans have any progress in closing that gap or if Democrats have widened it and what they're doing in terms of fundraising as we head into the key presidential election.
Thanks for digging into all this, JR, and thanks for joining me on Capitol Notes.
Anytime.
WUWM has a new politics podcast called Swing State of the Union. It explores why Wisconsin is a deeply purple state and why Wisconsin is so important in this year's election. The first episode is now available, and you can find it wherever you get your podcasts for the next 10 weeks leading up to the Republican National Convention. In about 15 minutes, we'll meet a 72-year-old woman who's about to graduate from UWM. But first, yesterday marked the anniversary of the Bayview Massacre. We'll learn what led up to the event, coming up on Lake Effect, on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. In the late 1800s, a movement was brewing in the Midwest. Industrial workers worked long hours with little pay, resulting in strikes and protests. But these protests turned deadly in Milwaukee on May 5, 1886, during a march on the Bayview Rolling Mills. The event became known as the Bayview Massacre. And since its centennial anniversary in 1986, the Wisconsin Labor History Society has commemorated the event with a ceremony on the former mill site in Bayview. Historian John Gerda has been a part of the commemoration for decades, and he joins me to explore the events that led to this tragedy. The Bayview Massacre, it didn't happen in a vacuum. This was really part of a larger movement happening throughout the country that all had to do with the 8-hour workday. What was that movement about?
It was about social justice and basic fairness. Conditions back then for the average worker were, they would be criminal today. So somebody working in a factory, the typical workday was at least 10 hours a day. It was often 12 hours a day. It was 6 days a week, routinely. You might have gotten maybe an hour less of work on a Saturday. And people on the lower level were making about maybe $1.50 a day, somewhere through there. And certainly money has become more inflated since then. But if you do the math, that's less than $3 an hour in modern terms. And that is without a shred of the kind of the safety net. There was no unemployment insurance. There was no health insurance, no workers' comp. You know, so if you lost a digit in the workplace, you were probably done if you couldn't somehow overcome that handicap. So unions, obviously, were created in Milwaukee way back to the years before cityhood in 1846 to try to strike a better balance. But it was not until a group called the Knights of Labor came along, who were a national union and very inclusive, all ethnic groups, men and women, all trades. They were the first one to kind of have a national platform, and their key plank on the platform was an 8-hour day without a cut in pay, which is a big deal, you know, if you're looking at 10, 12 hours a day. So Milwaukee and Chicago were the epicenters of that movement. It was important elsewhere, but the upper Midwest was where it really took root. So May 1st was set as the date for the adoption of the 8-hour day. The city of Milwaukee itself gave city employees the 8-hour day, but a lot of the private employers resisted. Not all, you know, some did sign on. But the result was that May 1st there was a general strike that pretty much shut down the city. But most workers were on strike, so it was a paralyzed community at a time when Milwaukee was the so-called machine shop of the world. You know, so this was a big deal to the local economy.
Why was Bayview, in many ways, the epicenter of this movement inside of Milwaukee?
Because the last major employer to resist the 8-hour day was a rolling mill that made iron products in Bayview, which at one time had roughly 1,500 workers. Hard to imagine today, but it was at the south end of the Danhone Bridge. They were employing 1,500 back in the 1870s, you know, the biggest private employer probably in the entire state. So they were the last ones of that size to say, no, I think we'll sit it out. So the morning of May 4th, there was a group of strikers, largely Polish, largely from the south side, who marched on that rolling mill, and they found the gates closed, and they sent a group in to meet with the management, and the management said, no thanks. We just finished a strike. You know, we're back to work, so please, we'll go about our business. By that time, people were throwing stones, and you know, they were dissatisfied with the result. They made it clear that they were going to come back the next morning, and this is a time, recall, when the Haymarket riot massacre happened in Chicago the night before, you know, May 4th. Tensions were just at an extraordinarily high point. So Governor Jeremiah Russ called out the militia, and a number of them were Poles, the Kosciuszko Guard, you know, who came down to essentially point guns at their neighbors. You know, so it was really, really a fraught time. And again, roughly 1,500 marched down from St. Stanislaus Church in the morning of May 5th, and there was no National Guard at the time. This was pretty much militia, you know, kind of rather loosely organized without a huge kind of an infrastructure. They had spent the night inside the plant gates. Rusk had come to Milwaukee by then and pretty much said, use deadly force.
That's what I don't understand. There was, of course, this militia, as you say, that had built up, but I don't understand why they were told to use deadly force, aside from that, you know, there were certainly a lot of people protesting. Was that the impetus?
I think it was largely fear of anarchy. And recall, this is not a time of rubber bullets or tear gas. You know, this was not that they would have used that anyway. This was lethal force. So a really chilling kind of anecdote from that period is the captain of the militia, they began to approach the mill, and he said, pick out your man and kill him. So this was not just fire over their heads to scare them. You know, this was shoot to kill. And I think the message they were sending and responding to was basically that industrial property is of higher value than industrial workers. And that became a real point of resentment in the time that followed. It happened the night before as well, you know, in Haymarket. You know, someone threw a bomb and, you know, there was sort of chaos ensued. So the workers came the morning of May 5th and the militia was there. The captain, same guy who says shoot to kill, at a distance of roughly 200 yards, order them to halt. This is before bullhorns and loudspeakers. You know, the 1,500 people, you know, they could not possibly have heard them. So they kept on marching. The militia opened fire and killed. It's an undetermined, the number we use is seven, undetermined number, but at least seven. And they included a 13-year-old schoolboy who was playing hooky, and a guy from Bayview was just watching from his backyard. So it was rather broad fire. And the result was that it broke the crowd. You know, they ran pell-mell back to the city. And there's some very colorful, very gruesome, it's a war zone, you know, kind of descriptions about crimson blood imparting a scarlet hue to the grass and the railroad embankment, held in the arms of his countrymen, father so-and-so gave last rites. You know, so these are largely Polish Catholics, you know, who are the victims here. And that broke the back of the eight-hour movement in Milwaukee. But what it really did in a larger sense was it galvanized those workers to organize politically. So this is the beginning of kind of labor-oriented politics in Milwaukee, which became a really important movement here. So the People's Party was organized the next election, and they swept in the fall elections of 1886.
As you say, this was really the impetus, it seems, for what became the defining political party for Milwaukee in the 20th century, the Socialists.
It was a major factor. You know, there were other forces at work. You had a lot of German workers who were receptive to these intellectual currents coming from the old country. You had Victor Berger, who was an organizational genius at the time. But in terms of the tinder that's lying there, the match, in many ways, was the shootings in Bayview that really ignited the movement, ignited protest. And that lasted through one election cycle, and then the Republican Democrats together mounted, they called it the Fusion Party, and people would argue that that would show their ideological bankruptcy, that they could come together, despite their rather opposed views, to fight, in their terms, this threat to democracy, the Socialists. But the workers didn't go away. They did not go away. So you have the movement kind of gather speed. 1898 is the first time the Socialist Party, the Social Democrats, begin to run candidates for office. And 1910 is when you have the first Socialist to govern a major American city, a pattern maker named Emil Seidel. And that lasted till 1960 when Frank Zeidler stepped down as the mayor, you know, our last Socialist, or as he would prefer to say it, the most recent Socialist in Milwaukee's history. So you have this movement that lasted into the later 20th century, you know, that goes back to 1886, you know, those events in the first week of May back in 1886.
What I think is interesting about looking at this movement right now, we in Milwaukee and throughout the nation are having, again, a similar kind of labor movement. We're seeing a lot of unionization efforts in a variety of industries. Coffee houses are one that come to mind immediately.
Right.
But there are a lot of different industries that are really trying to unionize in a similar way, looking at what we've seen as kind of the norm and questioning whether or not that should be the norm in the workplace.
Yeah, certainly the terms have changed, the context has changed. Healthcare workers, you know, certainly there's a great deal of organizing going on there. But what has happened in a larger sense is that back in those days, the turn of the 20th century, more than half of Milwaukee's workers were in production jobs. their manufacturing workers. Today, it's less than 14%. You know, so the context, the venues have changed, but the cause is eternal. You know, regardless of what field you're working in, you know, justice, equity, and having a voice in the terms of your employment and some leverage in your compensation as well. No, those are kind of the evergreen, the underlying tenets of a still an active labor movement, you know, that is not as ubiquitous as it was around the time of the Knights of Labor and especially later, you know, in the 20th century, but very much the same roots and very much the same issues.
Now, looking at specifically the Bayview Massacre, of course, this is something that I think we've revisited a lot as a city, especially since 1986 when we started this celebration. Celebration might be the wrong
commemoration.
Word. Commemoration of the events that happened in Bayview. And that'll happen again this weekend.
May 7th, 3 o'clock. And we always meet on the corner of Russell and Superior Street, which is actually on the Rolling Mills property. There's a historical marker there. And there'll be a reenactment of the events without live fire. And then there'll be the puppets are back, you know, the big puppets of capital as well as labor. There'll be speeches. You'll have some politicians, you know, giving very, very brief remarks and songs, you know, including one called The Ghost of Bayview by Larry Penn, who was a longtime pillar of that commemoration. So we've been doing it since 1986, and it continues. Kind of the godfather for many years was Frank Zeidler. You know, he was a key figure there, would always talk. And one of the highlights was near the end, we would always pass his fedora for donations to defray the expenses of the event. And Frank's gone, but his fedora's still there.
Well, John, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
My pleasure, Joy.
John Gerda is a local historian and the author of many books on the history of Milwaukee. We spoke last year. A 72-year-old woman is about to graduate with her bachelor's degree from UW-Milwaukee. We'll hear what inspired her to go back to school next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. How late is too late to go back to college? For UWM student Joanne Potter, the answer is it's never too late. After working as a business executive, private school teacher, and writer, she decided to finish college in her 70s. Now at age 72, Potter is about to graduate with a bachelor's degree in philosophy. That makes her one of just a few senior citizens earning bachelor's degrees at UWM. And Potter is most likely the oldest person to attend UWM's Honors College, a program for high-achieving students. WUWM editor Emily Files speaks with Potter about going back to college in her 70s and what she's learned from the younger generation.
I've married. I had 2 children. I have 5 grandchildren. I've had 3 careers. It's like, you know, you live a life. And I got to the point where I could take a breath and look around and say, what are the things that I wished I'd done? And one of the things I wished I'd done is finish college. I went to UWM in 1969 and did my freshman year not particularly well and quit and always regretted it. I was sorry that I didn't have a college degree, both practically and intellectually, because it held me back in my first career, which was a business career. And I ended up getting where I wanted to go in the end, but it was a lot harder.
So what was that decision like? Were you hesitant at all, or were you sure that that's what you wanted to do?
Well, my kids have long since become used to me making what might look on the face of them like irrational decisions. In the 80s, I drove my own race car. And just before leaving Richland Center, I went to Italy for a month by myself. I mean, never having been overseas. Mm-hmm. So, you know, asking them wouldn't have been a good test because they're like, it's just mom. Mm-hmm. So I called a couple of friends of mine who had been friends and mentors over the years. And I say, if I do this, is this like a stupid thing to do? And they said, absolutely not. Go. So I decided this in November of 2019, not realizing that the registration date for school was long past. But they pulled out some plugs for me, and I got in and started that January. And the odd thing was this, is when I talked to one of the counselors, they told me that all the credits I'd taken in 1969 were going to count.
Wow.
And I'd taken classes off and on in the ensuing years, enough to fill up my sophomore year. Mm-hmm. All those were going to count. Mm-hmm. So I could start back in 2022 as a junior.
Okay. So your like English 101 class or like math 101 class in 1969 counted in 2022.
All done. The only thing they told me was that if I wanted to be a nurse, mm-hmm. and I had taken biology in 1969, I would have to take that over.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense.
But they were all gen eds. It didn't matter.
Yeah. So tell me about the major that you chose and also applying for the Honors College.
I'll start with Honors College because that was an amazing experience. As it turns out, the Honors College is really unique in that all their classes are interdisciplinary. All their classes are taught 15 students or less on a seminar basis. And they're fascinating. When I look through the catalog, I would say, gosh, I want to take this. I want to take this. They were so cool. Mm-hmm. Like I'm taking now, I'm taking a class called Radical Beauty that talks about pre-Raphaelite artists as well as the history that goes along with them. So you've got an interdisciplinary thing. Another one that I'm taking is called The Oldest Hatred. And I took it particularly this semester because it's about anti-Semitism. Mm. So it's dealing with the history and the cultural part of it, as well as current events. Mm-hmm. So they're great, great classes.
So you've been taking the Honors College classes, and then your major is philosophy, right?
Yes.
So how'd you decide on that major, and how have those classes been?
That was the intent in going back, because I didn't know about Honors College when I first went back. Philosophy was the purpose, and it was because I had spent most of my adult life studying and understanding faith-based information, okay? I'm a person of faith. And increasingly, it got to the point where the church was either unable or unwilling to answer the questions that I was asking. And I finally realized that it was like I was inside of a box trying to kick my way out. So I said, okay, where can I go to get answers to these questions? And I realized that the questions I was asking in many ways were philosophical ones. And I said, well, darn it, I'll just go back to school and study philosophy, and maybe they can lead me down the way I needed to go. And it has paid off in spades. I've gotten way more than I even expected to get. One thing I did not know is that the philosophy department at UWM is... the graduate program in particular is a destination. Hmm. There are students who come there from all over the world to study with intent at UWM in their graduate program because their philosophy department is that good. The undergraduate advisor, August Magnusson, is a sensational instructor. More than any other person in the department, he has helped me find what I was looking for when I came. Mm-hmm. And that has been a real privilege, mm-hmm. a real privilege.
So you really thought about going to college as a way to, as like a knowledge building and a way to like find answers that you've been looking for throughout your life.
And I'm not alone. You know, I'll sit there in class, whether it's with graduates or undergraduates, and everybody is asking the same questions. Something very unusual happened when I came back in 2022. I walked on campus and I saw, you know, the students, and I started walking around. I'm going, this feels really familiar. And it wasn't the buildings or the geography or anything like that. It was something else. It was a feeling. It was a kind of an undercurrent. And I said, this, it felt like this in 1969 when we were the hippies who were going to change the world. But there was a feeling that the world needed changing and we were going to be the ones to do it. Hmm. That same feeling was there when I came back in 2022. And now you look around, it's starting to blow up a little bit. But the students who are in college now feel that same way. They look around at the politics and the economics and the social stuff that's going on, and they're going, wait a minute, we can do better. Let's see if we can find a way to do better. Only there's a real big difference. In spite of the protests that are happening all over the country, their way of solving their problem is almost a 180 different from the way we thought we would solve ours. You know, instead of saying, like we did, I don't trust anybody over 30, and we meant it, they're saying, no, we're going to do this together. And they did something I never expected. They welcomed me back. They said, hey, you're interesting. We want to get to know you. Tell us what you know. Tell us about your life. Come and, you know, go out. Let's go, you know, let's go have coffee, or let's do this and talk about this. It's amazing. I never expected that. I expected to be marginalized and kicked in a corner and, you know, accommodated, but, you know, and exactly the opposite happened. I have tons of friends. We do stuff together. We experience things together. We meet for coffee. We talk about current events. We talk about our families. It's an amazing place right now.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So you expected to feel like an outsider, but you were welcomed.
Exactly.
Even though you probably were the only 70-something-year-old in a lot of your classes?
Well, there's a lot of people who audit, mm-hmm. and they're still there too. Now, they don't. It's a whole different experience, I think, if you don't have skin in the game, if you're not taking the tests.
And auditing is basically when someone goes to the classes, but they're not taking it for credit.
No, they're not taking it for credit, nor are they obligated to the homework.
Okay.
And I think one of the reasons that I kind of got adopted by students is that they knew I was doing everything that they had to do. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of cool. I think that the more people who show up on campus who are non-traditional, whether they're students or auditors, add to the landscape. And now it's an environment where those people are absolutely welcomed, not only by the students, but by the instructors. They love them.
So what do you feel like the 20-something-year-olds taught you, and what do you feel like you taught them?
Can I tell a little story about mm-hmm. that? One of the guys who I've taken a number of philosophy classes with, a senior auditor, and he's been around a long time, and I think he's older than me, believe it or not. And he asked me one day, he said, what do you think is the biggest difference between when we were 20, in our 20s, going to college, and these students? And my first response was, they're smarter, and they are. They're better prepared. They have a better high school education than I ever did. Mm-hmm. And when they went into college, they were ready. And he says, I think you're wrong. And why? Because they're nicer. And they are. They are kinder. They are more polite. They are more respectful. It's amazing. And I didn't teach them this. This is what they taught me. They know that they will not. How can I say this? That the American dream is not going to be available to them. The opportunity that we had to have the house with the picket fence and the 2.5 kids and the, you know, and the dog and the suburbs and a job that we could have for 30 years and a Social Security retirement at the end of it, that they know that that's not going to happen for them. So they're going to try to figure out now what to do instead. And they're saying, okay, if I can't do that, what can I do with this? And then it becomes not an individual project, but a joint project, something they build with the other people in their profession, something they build with the people in their community. It's a whole different way of looking at the world, and it is exciting.
Joanne Potter is a UWM student who's about to graduate with her bachelor's degree at 72. She spoke with WUWM editor Emily Files. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll look at what's in the Milwaukee Public Schools' proposed budget. Plus, we'll learn about the invasive spongy moth that could become a big problem this year. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.